Scott Kelly, the brother-in-law of Representative Gabrielle Giffords, observed from the International Space Station that this planet looks so beautiful, so blue, so green, so peaceful from a distance. Implicit in his observation is the sad fact that as we turn up the focus, as we come down from the skies and observe those beautiful seas, those seas are roiled with waves and with wavelets, or with tsunamis. Our cities are filled with people living lives of quiet and noisy desperation. The majority of people in the majority of towns, in the majority of countries, in the majority of churches and synagogues and mosques and ashrams are good and decent and peaceful. And yet when we turn the magnification up, we feel the anger. This weekend, as I mentioned in opening words, this week is bookmarked from the shootings in Arizona to Martin Luther King's birthday to a change of regime of violence and of hope in Tunisia. All of this is particularly poignant to me because I was living in Tunisia as part of the Peace Corps when Martin Luther King was assassinated. And I had the horrifying job of trying to explain to my students why. And of course, I had no answer in terms of why, except that an angry person acting out of a climate of hate and fear, rage and projection can take the life of a great person or an average person or any person. Our hearts are not better or worse than the hearts and the souls of people of other nations. But when we look at our society, when we look at the violence, we have to be asking a bunch of questions. And being Unitarian Universalists, we don't necessarily have to have one answer or agree on that one answer, but we have to wrestle faithfully with the great issues that are before us. I talked last week mostly about the climate, the temperature in the mineshaft of our society, the toxic elements that the reason that we have the metaphor of canaries in a mineshaft is that the canaries, being small and vulnerable animals, they would feel a toxic environment first and they would die. And when you saw the canaries in the mine shaft dying, it was a clue. Let's get out of here. Our social mine shaft is pretty heated. And if we consider the canaries to be those who are unstable, we need to take the heating conditions seriously. The global warming of rhetoric may be as important individually as the questions of global warming and global temperature change, because we cannot escape this air that we all breathe and the rage that is out there that involves the diminishment and the dehumanizing of the other. That's one important factor in this week. Another obvious and important factor is the issue of mental health. What do we do about mental health services? And the answer is, as a society, not very much. It's underfunded, underappreciated, and people with mental illnesses are marginalized by our society. And we, frankly, don't know what to do with them. We don't know what to do with the label. There's a remarkable passage in Jean-Paul Sartre's book, Nausea, La Nausea, and in which people are sitting in a bar and somebody walks in and this person's acting weirdly and they're all disturbed. And when finally they say, oh, just a second, there's a mental hospital nearby, it's somebody who's escaped, they all feel relieved because they felt that they tamed it by putting a name on it. Well, we can put names in all of the different disorders in the diagnostic manual, and that doesn't necessarily get us closer to issues of treatment. It's hard to treat people for mental disease, and it should be. We should not be able to take away people's freedom easily, just because if the standard for taking away somebody's freedom and making them medicate is simply being weird, half this room is out of here. And I'm with you, by the way, so, you know, I'm not casting aspersions. It should be difficult. I studied psychotherapy in Vienna. I interned in Napa State Mental Hospital. It should be hard to restrict somebody's freedom and give them medications. We don't want to be like the old Soviet Union, where we basically use psychological diagnosis in order to remove people who are just a pain. And we are extraordinarily bad at predicting who is going to just be weird, whose voices are going to be benign, and whose voices are going to objectify and lead them to destroy. We don't know. Most psychologists, psychiatrists, psychoanalysts are pretty good at predicting some early pathologies with children. Torturing animals is always a tell. But with late onset psychiatric diseases, it's very difficult to know. And so we move forward handicapped by a lack of really good diagnostic criteria, a lack of being able to predict, laws that protect privacy and have a very high and should have a high standard of danger to self and others, medications that have terrible side effects. I've known, and be very personal about this, I lost a stepsister who was bipolar, and she loved being manic and would not take her meds, and she hated being depressed and would double up her meds until she OD'd. That's not unusual. I've known people who like the voices in their heads, and I've known people who have not liked the voices in their heads but were more embarrassed by tardive dyskinesia, which is the herky-jerky movement that you will sometimes see with people on heavy antipsychotics, than they were by the voices in their heads. This is very hard stuff, and I don't want to do the simple thing if there were only enough money, because across the spectrum, people have legitimate concerns about how do we treat, even if we have the money. What should the laws be? What should the criteria be? And I tell you from the bottom of my heart, I don't have really good answers here. This is individual, and it is delicate. And at what point in some spiral, when we know that somebody is weird, does it become too weird? Another true story. There was somebody in my class at seminary who all of a sudden started acting religiously. Now, this was at a Unitarian Universalist seminary, and we all thought that she was getting a little strange, and we were in Berkeley, so we were supposed to be opening up our spirituality and our spiritual vocabulary, and she started talking about how God was talking to her, and we affirmed her, and we confirmed her, and we enabled her, and finally she got up in First Unitarian Church in San Francisco, and she preached and prophesied mightily, mightily, and they carried her away. Had it been in a Baptist church, they would have taken a collection, and it would have done really well. The point being that it was the context of the action. It was the context. It was the appropriateness. This was not, I just did not slam the Baptist. That's a perfectly appropriate language and cadence to use within those circumstances. But if you've forgotten you're in a Unitarian church, you've lost track of where you are. And that's part of what the mental health issue is. We lose track of appropriateness. My clinical supervisor at Napa, And I've used this example before, and sometimes I get agreement and sometimes I get argument, but it's a little oversimple, but with most, it has a good deal of truth to it. He said to me that the difference between you and the people here is that you can still fake being in control and being appropriate. Your thoughts, your impulses are as nuts as anybody in the hospital. That you could be sitting in a concert and say to yourself, what am I doing here? You call this junk music? You could be sitting in a meeting and want to stand up and just yell, that's the most idiotic stuff I've ever heard. You could be sitting in an office and want to throw an ashtray, they had ashtrays back then, through a window and shatter it. But you don't. You can still fake being under control and handling the world with equanimity. Yeah, mostly I can still fake that. But they can't. We're talking about stuff that's really hard and heartbreaking. When and how do we intervene? And to just push it out as a huge social problem out there for someone else, it is a huge social problem out there for someone else, but it's also a problem for all of us to deal with the people who are hurting and are not reacting in what we call a normal manner. And it's difficult for all of us to say, I'm sorry, that's too far. You can't be here anymore, or the nature of our relationship has to change. It's heartbreaking from parent to child. It's heartbreaking from child to parent. As many of you know, my mother-in-law is suffering from dementia. It's hard when other people have lost hold and we don't know what to do and there isn't one good answer. So it's not simply some them out there. The last and obvious part of all of this is guns. Since Bobby Kennedy's assassination, and again, opening words, I was in Tunisia when that happened. 1 million Americans have died by domestic gun violence. That's 333 9/11s. That's 40,000 a year, with another 60,000 injured by gun violence. Houston, we have a problem. If we don't at least talk about this, we can never deal with something that under other circumstances most people would be yelling and screaming about. Now, I am not about to go into a complete anti-gun rant, as you might expect from a Unitarian Universalist minister, because I need to confess to you that I have target shot, that I have done a lot of skeet shooting, and that I have hunted for food, not for trophies. I was a card-carrying member of the NRA, and I tore up my card when their rationale changed from reasonable to, I think, insane. To say that people need guns for target shooting, okay, that's usually one shot at a time if it's an Olympic event. To say that you need guns for self-protection, okay. If you need a gun for self-protection, get a shotgun. An Uzi is the last gun that Alice should try to use to protect her home, because it will knock her over and put holes in the ceiling and not in anybody else. A shotgun would be your protection, were you to decide to do that, which is unlikely at best. But there's no rationale for an Uzi for home protection. There's no rationale for automatic, semi-automatic weapons with 30 magazine clips for hunting. If you take a Glock 9mm with 30 clips and go over to the flyway in Riverside to hunt goose, if you shoot a goose with that, there won't be enough goose left for you to cook. You'll have some feathers to stuff your pillows. When the NRA said no restrictions on assault weapons, and when the NRA said no restrictions on armor-piercing bullets, those are not for target shooting. These are only for hunting and killing human beings. So the NRA's story changed from sport and protection to the ability to carry on a revolution against the government's tyranny. At that point, my card went up in flames, because that's a different issue. A different issue entirely. What happens is the slippery slope argument is, if you start restricting our armor-piercing bullets, soon you'll be in my house taking my whammo slingshot. It's the slippery slope argument, and it's nonsense. We don't need these clips, these guns, this firepower in this nation, particularly when we are fueled with the kind of heat that is going on in this particular mineshaft. We need to be able to have reasonable discussions about these great and terrible issues, because it is not that our hearts have changed, but our firepower has changed. The damage I can do with a stick and a stone is significant to an individual, but me with a stick and a stone, I can't take out 19 people. And we all know what takeout means. It's not for coffee. When we look at the rage that is seizing in our society, it's important to understand where it starts. And I'm not putting it all on the political tone. I'm putting it all on what seems to me to be fundamentally true about human beings. And that is that the biggest problem that we have in our society is them. We make thems out there. We look for good examples of what we consider to be bad people so that we can hate them. Now, some of them are worthy of being hated. I'm not going to give you a big song and dance about how I just loved my interaction when I was talking with the Westboro Baptists, who show up with a theology that says the problem in America is that America doesn't hate fags as much as their little God hates fags. Now, that's bad religion, that's bad theology, that's bad language, that's bad all of this stuff. And I'm not saying we don't push back against what we see as bad or even as evil, but we try to look at what the causes of their anger, their fear, their rage, their projections might be. This is a rhetorical question, you don't have to answer it. But have you ever been to a Nazi rally? I have. As a journalist. It's pretty pathetic. The master race, you look at these people, and they don't look like a master race. I don't think they're the master race, and deep down, they don't think so either. And they are projecting their inadequacies, their fear, their symbolic and probably physical impotence out onto others. They're sad. Now, I'm not defending them and saying open up your hearts to the Nazis or to Westboro Baptist Church, but I am saying that the issues that we can deal with in our own hearts are important. When I meet somebody that I instinctively don't like, and that doesn't happen too terribly often, it's usually because they're doing something that I do, that I don't like in myself. There's an awful lot of our anger and our rage comes from wrestling demons that we cannot admit to ourselves. I understand it's Psych 101 and surprises no one every time some vitriolic anti-gay preacher gets caught in a compromising position, because the person is trying to exorcise his own demons. We see this in areas of politics. We see it when you find what people hate, what they are monomaniacally obsessed with. They are obsessed with controlling their own demons. That's why it's so important when we start a journey towards healing, towards understanding, and towards pushing back against what we see as problematic and troubling, that we do that as human to human. Our hymn, our second hymn, which is the Black National Anthem, talks about the journey that we have made and how difficult it was. And I'm sure some beige people in here were saying, what do you mean? That wasn't my journey. Yes, it was. Every Jew is said to have been present at Sinai when the Ten Commandments were given and to have been part of the Exodus. Every Christian is told that you were there on Good Friday at the foot of the cross. It's your story. The civil rights journey, the journey towards justice, the journey towards healing, the dream that Martin Luther King had, we are a part of that journey as Americans, as Unitarian Universalists, as human beings. The great inspiration that Martin Luther King was able to deliver was in seeing that love was not necessarily agreement with the opposition, but it was the acknowledgement of the humanity in the opposition. It was looking into the eyes of the sheriff, of the marshal, of the policeman, and trying to connect two sparks of humanity together. We do not heal by hate. We may heal by opposition. We may heal by speaking our truths to power and our truths for the powerless. But it begins with a sense of our own humanity, a search for the humanity in others, and a commitment, a difficult, knowing commitment, not to do and not to become those things that we hate, and we do hate, and fear, and we do fear. We can choose to step back and open our eyes, our arms, and our hearts to the other.